Be honest, I didn't know that I was going to be resuming CE just yet, and I don't remember where we left off in the spring. I know that we were in 1 Samuel together. Yeah. I think we can combine a couple things, actually. I think possibly we'd gotten to David's anointing in 1 Samuel 16. We were sneaking up on it, at any rate. And the very next thing is David and Goliath. So let me see if our whiteboard's in here, and let's just jump in there. So let's look at 1 Samuel 17. Excellent. Of course, we met a few times online after the last time we wrote on this whiteboard. I'm pretty sure we talked about David and his armor bearer, which is 14. But I think it's okay to skip a little bit. Here's that questions for careful readers handout. If you don't know where yours is and would like another one, I'll just let that float around. I'm sure we could make a couple copies if we need. There's a phrase that dominated kind of the century of higher criticism, the 19th century, and kind of the move behind European higher criticism that I'd like to talk about for a bit as we jump in and kind of pick up reading where we were. Kind of a motto, the way they approach the text. Well, the way they say they approach the text, more like it. Bible is a book like any other book, with the implication that the Bible should be read like any other book. I'm curious what your reactions are to that, because I've got some thoughts. Tony thinks it's blasphemy, okay? If that's blasphemy, does that mean we need special glasses to be able to read the Bible? Okay, we need the Holy Spirit. Okay, Rose? Rose says it's in certain senses, but we need qualifications. Okay. I like that. I like that. I would suggest the major problem that came out of a movement that used this as a motto is that they said that, but they didn't do it. They didn't read the Bible like any other book, right? You don't pick up Lord of the Rings and start reading and start picking apart different source material and deciding, you know, there was obviously a version of this where Smeagol was the hero, and there's been a pro-Hobbit redaction that has buried that under several different layers. That's not reading it like any other book, right? But there's a real sense, I think, yes, in order to read it rightly, we need the Holy Spirit. Absolutely, we need to the extent that we agree with this, we need to agree to it with certain qualifications. But part of learning to read it well is remembering that there is a real sense in which we can read it like any other book, right? We can start at the beginning and we can read through, and we can read things and see that they're not in chronological order. There's something else going on there, and not be surprised by that, right? we can see that the tools for characterizing someone and painting them in a particular way are an active part of something that the biblical authors use, that they want us to notice so that we can see what's going on. All of the things that are working for us when we sit down and read a novel will help us sit down and read narrative in the Bible, and not just narrative. And in fact, I would argue that aside from prayer, which we obviously need, right, one of the most helpful practical things for learning to read the Bible well is to read fiction. Read fiction. Because as we read fiction well, and as we grow accustomed to all of the tools that are used by an author to write narrative, we become attentive to those kinds of details. Right? When an English teacher tells us about all of these details, we're not attentive, even when we take notes, right? I remember sitting in Old Testament classes in seminary thinking, gee, I wish my high school English teacher had taught me these things. And then thinking after class, you know, I think she did. And it's one thing when someone assigns a book and you have to read it, right? Then often you don't really enjoy it. But when we read something that we enjoy, we build those skills that help us enjoy other literature well, but also help us read the Bible well. So there's one practical tip I can give you aside from, right, read regularly, read with prayer, read with the expectation that you won't understand everything, and write your questions down and keep reading anyway. The other thing I would say is read fiction, and read a lot of fiction, and pay attention to how the stories are put together and what devices are used and how someone presents their characters, and then use that to read true stories. So, Tony. There is great art in the Bible, and it's much to our benefit spiritually, I think, to appreciate and understand and see that art. That's not something that's in conflict. So, Mike.
And so the same is true of the Word. We say we have to realize our God is speaking. It's God who's speaking. So there are certain things that are true in the Bible when we read it in any other book. When I read any other book, for instance, even if I read fiction, usually fiction authors have a message or something that they're trying to communicate. Often that message is very artfully rendered. And all the conventions that he used in literature to communicate. And really, it's a good thing because the depth When they apply that statement, I can't assume, well, Paul said one thing and James said another thing, and they may very well be contradictory in what they're saying.
Yeah.
They may have contradictory and conflicting understandings of the truth. No, because ultimately God is the author, I say no, have complementary understandings of the truth that are expressed in different.
I think if I can summarize Mike's comment for the recording, I think to take this, right, the Bible is a book like any other book, or we should read it like any other book. There's yes and no, and the yes is the means employed to communicate are the same means you'd find in any other book. But the authority of the one who tells us those things is absolute. And so in that sense, it is not at all like any other book. Yeah. So we can read with attention. And we can read with a suspicion that is suspicious of ourselves as we read. Or suspicious of the things that we want to make of it right away as we read. But we can't apply the same kind of hermeneutic of suspicion, so to speak, that we might apply when we're reading something someone has written, and we're not sure if we want to submit to what they're telling us. We don't have that option. Even though we often exercise it, it's not an option that's open to us. Yeah. So I wish Mike had the microphone. All of that was good. So, yeah.
The ways in which we don't submit to the Bible, even when we acknowledge that we should, as Orthodox Christians, very subtle, often very subtle. And what happens is, and that often involves the interpretive process. We have to realize, in being suspicious of ourselves, like you said, that we have a capacity to manipulate the interpretive process.
Yes. Yes, we're very adept at goal-oriented reading. I already know what it says, and so as I read it, I'm going to fit it into that box. So, with those things in mind, oh, yes, Ron.
This thing on fiction.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of sitting down, watching various movies, whatever the reason, these fictional accounts of shows, most of where that is that fiction, don't have to deal with real reality. And so I just thought that.
Yes. Yes.
How you bring this here? It may not be contradictory at all. Focus on what you're consuming, why you're consuming it. It's, most of it is passive as far as that goes.
Yes.
But also, it's a means of escaping a lot of times. And I'm not into escaping life. I don't want to enjoy it. Mm-hmm. And it's true.
This is true.
When you say it that, that's
yeah.
Another thing is, what kinds of fictions or genre or how can we be selective about fiction?
Yeah, so if I'm going to recommend that we read fiction to help us read the Bible better, right? That's a powder keg. Especially because we have a couple of generations in a row who've been raised with this idea that fiction is bad. Fiction will, was it General Lee who thought fiction rots your mind, and so he wouldn't read any fiction? Because these are just made up stories, right? And they don't have to do with anything that's real. Not all of it, right? And I can certainly say that some fiction is better than other fiction. But what if fiction does something else for us than teach us facts? I would think the best fiction, aside from teaching us how to read, and teaching us how to read well, also forms our soul, helps us understand others, others who are not like us, takes us out of the places where we are comfortable and familiar, and exposes us to others, to other people, other places, other ideas. Because of that, fiction can be very unhelpful. Absolutely. Right? It can try to shape us in ways that we love things that are not lovely, for example. But fiction also has the power to show us that we're not as different from one another as we think we are. I think one thing we find as we read Old Testament narrative, for instance, is that there are elements of the culture that seem very strange and foreign, and it makes it feel like this is a whole other country. But there are things that the patriarchs do. Right? There are ways Joseph interacts with his brothers. Right? That happened in the car on the way here this morning. Right? That we are the same kind of people that they were. So the things that mattered for them matter for us. So what kind of fiction? Well, I have some authors that I think are amazing and would recommend. And then usually what happens is I recommend an author to someone and then I go read a couple of other things they wrote and then I have to go back and say, except these things, not those things, right? Read these, but not those. So always read carefully. Always read carefully. But I would say start by finding someone who writes well. Yeah. And just pay attention to how they tell their stories. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a
Mm-hmm. It traumatizes certain truths. And so where you really see this is when you see parallel accounts that are different. So, yeah. So the Gospels, great example. Mark has a different thing sometimes in mind in telling the very exact same story than Matthew does. And Luke really does. And John,
yeah. Yeah, so the classic example from Samuel versus Chronicles is that Chronicles skips entirely over the episode with Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. You can see where he's following the account in 2 Samuel, and he leaves out about a chapter. He has the last of this, the last verse here and the first verse here. So...
Mm-hmm. And it's not that what he's saying isn't true. It's that what he's trying to convey through David to the wife of David is one thing. And what Samuel and Kings are trying to convey through those same episodes is something different.
So this is part of what I mean when I say that what they did in 19th century higher criticism and later is not read the Bible like any other book. Because they came to the Bible, and the Old Testament in particular, and were very, very frustrated that they couldn't write a history, like a straightforward, positivist history of just the facts, ma'am, for Israel, based on Samuel and Kings and Chronicles. Because Samuel and Kings and Chronicles and the other books of the Old Testament, they present that history from a particular perspective. Because they're trying to teach. They're trying to get you to see what is true and what is good and what is beautiful and to love that and to see what is sinful and to avoid that. And so other aspects of Israel and Judah's interaction with the world nations, their relative place, you know, how high they are in the dog pile, is not really on the horizon for the Deuteronomist, if we want to use one of their terms. Not because he didn't know or didn't care, but because it's not material to what he's doing. And so for these critics in particular, that aspect became very frustrating. But they wouldn't expect that, right? They wouldn't expect to be able to reconstruct a history of... turn of the era Central Europe on the basis of the folk tales of the Brothers Grimm. Right? They wouldn't go and read other books in this way and experience the same frustration. So. Yeah. The telling of history is always selective. Yeah.
They can't put everything back.
Yeah.
So they choose.
Yeah.
The other, I wrote an interesting chapter in the book that James Gordon wrote, and that where I would contrast the Bible and Christians, is that this, he talked about the Gnostic tendencies of the church, where
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Which he says, the Bible doesn't let us do that.
Yeah.
Because it is a ideas.
Yeah.
But we can't do that in the Bible. Without the history, it turns into,
Yes. So we need to hold on to both of those things. We have to hold on to the authority of the one who tells us these things, even as we attend to the means that he uses. But if I want to stir things just a little bit more, might I suggest that we're not actually taking his authority seriously if we're not also attending to the means he uses to communicate? Or not as seriously as we should.
But they are, if they're good district textbooks, they are dealing with actual fact. Richard Pratt's book, he gave us stories, is really good on this. Our lives, and Tony mentioned some of that. Like I read a fiction and I see things going on, dynamics, the story of Joseph's brothers that happened to us on the way to church. That's reading it like we're here. I recognize, okay, this is speaking to where I am now and the ordinary situations with which I deal. And what does it say to me as God's truth in those situations?
I drove by myself on the way to church, so just to go back and clarify, right? I'm not talking about this morning.
Yeah.
Thanks, Mike. So the two most helpful books that I've encountered for thinking through more in greater detail how to read Old Testament narrative well, one is He Gave Us Stories by Richard Pratt. Extremely helpful. And he often looks at it on the analogy with film, where you can take a narrative, you can break it down into different scenes, and you can break those scenes down into different shots. And what do you notice about the shot and how it's framed and what's going on and how is the author lending a certain perspective to the text, right? And how do you notice in the Old Testament narrative things that you automatically pick up on in movies, right? Like the guy who walks in wearing a black hat and the saloon goes quiet when he steps in, right? He's probably not the hero. But what are the cues like that in biblical narrative that help us read it well? And he's extremely helpful there. And he's a believer, right? He taught at Reformed Seminary. He taught Mike, I think, right? Yeah, I took a class from him as well. He's really, really helpful. The other one, who's written not by a believer, but an extremely gifted reader of texts, is by Robert Alter, The Art of Biblical Narrative. It's important to remember that he's not a believer, but he's very, very good at attending to the details of the text and kind of teaching by example. So, it was The Art of Biblical Narrative. And he's gone on and done some translations of the Old Testament where he has commentary, which are both delightful and very frustrating. Because he will point out details in the text that you might not otherwise see, because he's a medieval literature scholar. That's his thing. And he'll talk about how stupid the critics are because they don't notice this. And then on the next page, he'll be like, well, the critics say this, and so that must be. No. And then he'll keep going. So, but despite that, very, very helpful at kind of teaching us to attend to the details and see how the details can be important. So, with those things in mind, let's dive into 1 Samuel 17. This is David and Goliath, right? This is a supremely familiar story. It's a long one, so there's no way we'll make it all the way through. But it would be a good place to kind of test our attention to detail as we read the text. Just to summarize the few chapters before, right? Saul is king. Saul's been rejected. Jonathan has shown himself a promising heir. But Saul's line itself has also been rejected. David's been anointed king, but Saul is still acting king. No one knows. David's been anointed, essentially, except David and Samuel. And the Spirit of the Lord is tormenting Saul, but has rushed on and empowered David. David is serving in Saul's court as a musician to kind of ease Saul's suffering. And that's where we come into chapter 17, is the second half of 16, is David's been anointed, but now David is in service of the acting king, Saul. And then we get to chapter 17. So, now the Philistines gathered their armies for battle, and they were gathered at Soko, which belongs to Judah, and encamped between Soko and Azekah in Ephes-Damim. And Saul and the men of Israel were gathered and encamped in the valley of Elah, and drew up in line of battle against the Philistines. And the Philistines stood on the mountain on the one side, and Israel stood on the mountain on the other side, with a valley between them. And there came out from the camp of the Philistines a champion named Goliath of Gath, whose height was 6 cubits and a span. There's a text critical issue there we can talk about later. He had a helmet of bronze on his head, and he was armed with a coat of mail. And the weight of the coat was 5,000 shekels of bronze. Does anyone happen to have the New American Standard in front of them? Could you read for us verse 5?
He had a bronze helmet on his head, and he was clothed with scale armor, which weighed 5,000 shekels of bronze.
Okay. Pay attention to how his armor is described and how other armor is described. The New American Standard gave us scale armor. That's an important detail. And he had bronze armor on his legs, verse 6, and a javelin of bronze slung between his shoulders. The shaft of his spear was like a weaver's beam, and his spear's head weighed 600 shekels of iron, and his shield bearer went before him. He stood and shouted to the ranks of Israel, "Why have you come out to draw up for battle? Am I not a Philistine? And are you not servants of Saul? Choose a man for yourselves, and let him come down to me. If he is able to fight with me and kill me, then we will be your servants. But if I prevail against him and kill him, then you shall be our servants and serve us." And the Philistine said, "I defy the ranks of Israel this day. Give me a man, that we may fight together." When Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine, they were dismayed and greatly afraid. Now David was the son of an Ephrathite of Bethlehem in Judah, named Jesse, who had 8 sons. In the days of Saul, the man was already old and advanced in years. The 3 oldest sons of Jesse had followed Saul to the battle, and the names of his 3 sons who went to battle were Eliab the firstborn, and next to him Abinadab, and the 3rd Shammah. David was the youngest. The three eldest followed Saul, but David went back and forth from Saul to feed his father's sheep at Bethlehem. For 40 days the Philistine came forward and took his stand, morning and evening. And Jesse said to David, his son, take for your brothers an ephah of this parched grain and these 10 loaves and carry them quickly to the camp to your brothers. Also take these 10 cheeses to the commander of their 1,000. See if your brothers are well and bring some token from them. Now Saul and they and all the men of Israel were in the valley of Elah fighting with the Philistines. And David rose early in the morning and left the sheep with a keeper and took the provisions and went as Jesse had commanded him. And he came to the encampment as the host was going out to the battle line, shouting the war cry. And Israel and the Philistines drew up for battle, army against army. And David left the things in charge of the keeper of the baggage and ran to the ranks and went and greeted his brothers. As he talked with them, behold, the champion, the Philistine of Gath, Goliath by name, came up out of the ranks of the Philistines and spoke the same words as before. And David heard him. All the men of Israel, when they saw the man, fled from him and were much afraid. And the men of Israel said, have you seen this man who has come up? Surely he has come up to defy Israel. And the king will enrich the man who kills him with great riches and will give him his daughter and make his father's house free in Israel. And David said to the men who stood by him, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine and takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in the same way, so shall it be done to the man who kills him. Now Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spoke to the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, why have you come down? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your presumption and the evil of your heart, for you have come down to see the battle. And David said, what have I done now? Was it not but a word? And he turned away from him toward another and spoke in the same way. And the people answered him again as before. When the words that David spoke were heard, they repeated them before Saul, and he sent for him. And David said to Saul, let no man's heart fail because of him. Your servant will go and fight with this Philistine. And Saul said to David, you are not able to go against this Philistine to fight with him, for you are but a youth, and he has been a man of war from his youth. But David said to Saul, your servant used to keep sheep for his father. And when there came a lion or a bear and took a lamb from the flock, I went after him and struck him and delivered it out of his mouth. And if he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and struck him and killed him. Your servant has struck down both lions and bears, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, for he has defied the armies of the living God. And David said, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and from the paw of the bear will deliver me from the hand of this Philistine. And Saul said to David, go, and the Lord be with you. Then Saul clothed David with his armor. He put a helmet of bronze on his head and clothed him with a coat of mail. What's the New American Standard have there? Important difference in detail there. And David strapped his sword over his armor, and he tried in vain to go, for he had not tested them. Then David said to Saul, I cannot go with these, for I have not tested them. So David put them off. Then he took his staff in his hand and chose 5 smooth stones from the brook and put them in his shepherd's pouch. His sling was in his hand, and he approached the Philistine. And the Philistine moved forward and came near to David with his shield bearer in front of him. And when the Philistine looked and saw David, he disdained him, for he was but a youth, ruddy and handsome in appearance. And the Philistine said to David, am I a dog that you come to me with sticks? And the Philistine cursed David by his dogs, by his gods. The Philistine said to David, come to me, and I will give your flesh to the birds of the air and to the beasts of the field. Then David said to the Philistine, you come to me with a sword and with a spear and with a javelin, but I come to you in the name of the Lord of hosts, the God of the armies of Israel, whom you have defied. This day the Lord will deliver you into my hand, and I will strike you down and cut off your head. And I will give the dead bodies of the host of the Philistines this day to the birds of the air and to the wild beasts of the earth, that all the earth may know that there is a God in Israel, and that all this assembly may know that the Lord saves not with sword and spear, for the battle is the Lord's, and he will give you into our hand. When the Philistine arose and came and drew near to meet David, David ran quickly toward the battle line to meet the Philistine. And David put his hand in his bag and took out a stone and slung it and struck the Philistine on his forehead. The stone sank into his forehead, and he fell on his face to the ground. So David prevailed over the Philistine with a sling and with a stone, and struck the Philistine and killed him. There was no sword in the hand of David. Then David ran and stood over the Philistine and took his sword and drew it out of its sheath and killed him and cut off his head with it. When the Philistines saw that their champion was dead, they fled. And the men of Israel and Judah rose with a shout and pursued the Philistines as far as Gath and the gates of Ekron, so that the wounded Philistines fell on the way from Sha'araim as far as Gath and Ekron. And the people of Israel came back from chasing the Philistines, and they plundered their camp. And David took the head of the Philistine and brought it to Jerusalem, but he put his armor in his tent. As soon as Saul saw David go out against the Philistine, he said to Abner, the commander of the army, "Abner, whose son is this youth?" And Abner said, "As your soul lives, O king, I do not know." And the king said, "Inquire whose son the boy is." And as soon as David returned from striking down of the Philistine, Abner took him and brought him before Saul with the head of the Philistine in his hand. And Saul said to him, "Whose son are you, young man?" And David answered, "I am the son of your servant Jesse, the Bethlehemite." What do you notice? What strikes you about that? David shows great faith and great confidence. How does that contrast with the people around him? Greatly. Yeah. How is Saul described when we first meet him? Or a couple of chapters after we meet him, right? What happens when Israel gathers to make Saul king? He hides among the baggage. That doesn't work very well, right? Because he's so tall. He's a head taller than everyone. We come to this chapter, and this tall, powerful-looking, battle-proven king is where? Yeah, I mean, the more important thing is where isn't he, right? On the battle line, ready to meet the Philistine champion, right? And then we get David. Where does David come from? Tending the sheep, tending his father's sheep, right? Bringing a sack lunch to his brothers, right? Probably more provisions than that, but. And what do we know about David so far? We know he's young, we know he works in the wilderness, right? We learn more about him in this chapter. And there's a sense in which he comes from nowhere. But we also know when we come to this chapter that David has been anointed to replace Saul. And what do we know about Saul from the previous chapter? From the previous few chapters? Yeah, his dynasty is not going to continue. David's confident in the Lord, whereas Saul is blatantly disobedient.
Right. Also, and you don't see this so much with Saul, but you see it in other places with Saul. People like Saul, and the rest of Israel is concerned about the dignity of Israel and the honor of Israel. And David's concerned with the honor of God.
Yeah. David is concerned with the insult that this Philistine presents to the Lord. One thing that we also come out of the previous chapters with is this impression that Saul is slowly losing his grip. Losing his grip on everything. He's losing his grip on the kingdom, largely through his disobedience. He's losing his grip on reality. Right? As he's being tormented by this spirit, and David is part of the solution to that, which creates this really interesting tension between chapter 16 and chapter 17. Because Saul is sending messengers back and forth to Jesse to get David to come and be in his service in chapter 16. But in chapter 17, he doesn't know who David is. I don't think the important question here is did chapter 17 actually happen before chapter 16? So much as what impression does that leave you with of Saul? He doesn't pay much attention. This is just one more aspect of how the narrator is showing us that Saul's losing his grip. And he's not acting like a king. And this guy who comes in from the country, well, look what he does. There's so much more to talk about, but we're at time. I think Anne hasn't popped in yet, but she would have by now. So read back over that chapter a couple of times. Find a translation other than the ESV and use it to compare the armor, because that's important. But I'll let one of you see if you can tell us why that's important next week. That's also a good question. Where are the other brothers? He's got eight brothers. Well, if he's one of, yeah. Where are the rest? Rice? Oh, I'm not going to answer the question about the armor because it's 10:01. All right. Thank you all.